Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Stephen Donnelly, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
So how are you adjusting to being a former health minister and a former TD?
Well, I finished up 9 days ago, so the adjustment is just starting. The election obviously was in November, but the way it works is you continue in office until the new government is formed. So through December and January, we were still focusing on healthcare, on winter pressures, on service plans, on capital plans, and on all of that. So really that process begins now. Yeah.
So what have you been doing with yourself? Are you looking for a job?
Well, right now I'm professional fathering. I've got three young boys. My oldest at the last election, he was 11. He's about to turn 16. He's 6'1", 6'2", second row, looking down on me. So I'm trying to catch up, spend time with the boys, spend time with family, spend time with friends.
Are your kids, your wife, glad it's over?
Yeah, I think they are. You know, we can talk about the election and, you know, it was a disappointing outcome for me, but it was probably the best outcome for my family. Okay. Certainly the last 10 years, but particularly the last 5 years,
okay,
has been very, very intense. Great honour. I don't regret any of it,
yeah.
But certainly it doesn't lend itself to being the kind of dad and husband and son and brother and friend that you would want to be, you know.
Okay. So look, I think you're a pretty straight talking person, and I think you'd appreciate a straight conversation. So we'll try and have a straight conversation, will we? In terms of losing your seat, so you can blame constituency changes and Simon Harris being Taoiseach and all of that. But I suppose it must feel like, despite a high profile name recognition of being a minister, people chose not to vote for you. What happened?
I think a lot of different things happened. I think, as you say, there were movements in the constituency. We went from a 5-seater to a 4-seater. We had a very unusual situation where all 5 sitting TDs were in the 4-seater and 3 of the 5 were in the one town. We're in Greystones. So regardless of anything else, it was always going to be very difficult. Simon became Taoiseach. You know, he and I live about a kilometre and a half away from each other. So, you know, I had a Taoiseach in my hometown. Being Minister for Health doesn't help politically. You know, they turns out they call it the poison chalice for a reason. I think what was interesting is 3 Fianna Fáil TDs, sitting TDs, weren't re-elected. And 2 of the 3 were health ministers. So I don't think that helps.
It must be hard, though, not to take it personally on some level as a rejection of you, Stephen Donnelly, is it?
Look, it's not a pleasant experience. I've spoken over the years to a lot of people who lost their seats. None of them enjoyed it. You know, it's very public. And you care...
Kind of humiliation?
You care deeply about it. You know, I'm passionate about public service. I'm passionate about healthcare. I've been, you know, serving the people of Wicklow for 14 years. So you care, and I cared deeply about it. So for anyone who isn't returned, of course it's very disappointing. But on the flip side, Brendan, I ran 4 times. I was elected 3 of those 4 times. It was a huge honour to serve. It really was. I can't describe to you what an honour it is to go into Dáil Éireann on behalf of the people from your own community. What an honour it is to have had the opportunity to serve in government. I think probably, if I look back at the election, I wasn't in the constituency as much as I used to be. First 9 years, I was in the constituency a lot. I was in the constituency office a lot. We ran public meetings. We did a lot of these things. Over the last 5 years, the first 2 years was COVID. Obviously, that dominated everything. The only place I was in the Department of Health and then around the country in the health services. And then coming out of COVID, I knew there was about 2.5 years left. And I had a sense that we could really begin to get the health service moving back in the right direction. But I knew to do that, it was going to take everything I had.
So did you neglect your constituency? Did you neglect the local common a bit as well?
I think what I'm saying is I spent an awful lot of time working to get the health service back on track. I delivered a lot for the constituency, but I wasn't physically there as much. That was a conscious decision. You know, I felt we could begin to turn it. We could get the waiting times down. We could transform women's healthcare. We could bring in a new culture of productivity and reform. But it simply wasn't possible to do that and be physically present in the constituency as much as I used to be.
See, it might make you think then, if you're not cut out for Irish politics the way it works like that, are you a good policy wonk, a good technocrat, but maybe not that kind of emollient, agreeable personality who makes everybody happy and feel good?
I don't know. I think it's a fair question. Although it wouldn't stack up, would it? Because I was elected the first time I was elected, yeah. I had no right to be elected, right? I decided to run 5 weeks before the election.
The second, you were a very different prospect then, though, weren't you?
Maybe. The second time I topped the poll, which was a huge honour. Third time was more difficult. I had joined Fianna Fáil. That had annoyed a bunch of people. But got in. So look, maybe, who knows, right? Yeah. We've no surveys to know. But I think it was mainly a combination of changes within the constituency, the 5 to a 4 and the Taoiseach and all of that.
And you deciding to go off and me deciding.
Okay. Well, it's the opportunity to make things better for people in healthcare was a once in a lifetime opportunity. And if you were to say to me, okay, let's go back, would you choose not to have managed to do what happened in women's healthcare? Would you choose not to have got the waiting times down for people? Would you let any of that go in order to retain the seat? No, I wouldn't, because you're not there for yourself. You're there to serve your country. And I think if you have an opportunity like that to try and help people, you can't be putting your own considerations first. I think you have to put the country first. I think you have to put that, in my case, I think you have to put better health services for people ahead of your own self-interest.
Is there also a sense that, did you ever get over within Fianna Fáil that sense of being this Johnny-come-lately who came in and got a good job ahead of, like, you know, diehard party loyalists? Was there a bit of that within the party?
First, there might have been. I don't think there was after a while. Like, I was in Fianna Fáil for 8 years. I'm still in Fianna Fáil. I'm still a member. I ran.
Who are your friends and allies in Fianna Fáil?
Oh, well, I'm not going to start naming names, but I get on very well with people in Fianna Fáil.
Okay.
Right across the country. I have good friends. We've stayed in regular contact since the election. I was delighted to see some of them being elected to cabinet and being nominated to cabinet and to ministers of state as well. So no, I have enjoyed my time in Fianna Fáil. There's no question about it. I saw a serious group of people who were serious about serving their country, serious about being in government. I was very impressed by Micheál when I was, you know, outside of Fianna Fáil. I was very impressed by people in Fianna Fáil I'd worked with on the finance committee, people like Michael McGrath. So it was a group of people who struck me as serious, dedicated. It's been 8 years. I have to say it's been a good 8 years.
Okay. Just before we leave this general area, I heard a remark attributed to you. Now, you might say you never said this, that only in Ireland would an education in Harvard be held against you. Do you think, do some people hold it against you that you were a management consultant, you went to MIT and Harvard, McKinsey, all that, like too smart for his own good or something, bit of a know-all?
I don't know. Do they?
Did you say that?
I don't think so. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? I don't recall saying it. Who knows? I remember Michael Noonan saying to me once, very early on, he was health minister and I was in opposition trying to give out to him from time to time. And he was saying that traditionally in Irish politics, people do, you know, they might downplay their capability. And I'm not for a moment talking about myself. I was saying to him that I had been really, really impressed from within the Dáil, getting to know some of the people in opposition and in government, that I was very, very impressed by them. And it was their public personas didn't necessarily highlight that stuff. And he said, no, he said
people, that's Irish politics.
He said, people don't, you know, he said people don't. So look, I don't know about those things. Hopefully they helped in some way, you know?
Okay. So you mentioned COVID there, and I suppose in the history books, COVID will probably define your period as Minister for Health in lots of ways. And look, we could talk about COVID all morning. One question I'm interested in. Do you regret keeping children out of school as much as we did? Like, do you ever think we did permanent damage to a generation of kids? Because I do.
I think the decision to close the schools was taken at a time when we were really only learning about this disease, right? And you'll remember the teachers were worried themselves. We knew that children carried the disease. We were beginning to learn that it didn't affect them as much as older people like you and me, and then, you know, older people again. And there was a real concern. There was a real concern for the teachers. There was a real concern that the children would, you know, spread COVID to each other, and whilst they might be okay, then maybe they bring it back to granny and granddad, or maybe they bring it back to a brother or sister who has an underlying condition that makes them more vulnerable.
They were vectors. Vectors was the word at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah. Look, my own kids were out. Like, I remember trying to, my youngest would have been 5 at the time. I remember sitting at the table and his granny doing video calls with them, getting him to do his numbers and his letters and all of this. I think there's no question but that keeping kids out of school will have affected their education. You know, you talk to teachers.
Do you think your kids were affected by it now when you look at them? I hear so many parents start a sentence when they're talking about their kids, and they might be talking about anxiety or issues with learning Irish, maths, or in extreme cases, kids who have never really gone back to school properly. The sentence starts with, since COVID.
Yeah, I have the same conversations. Yeah, I talk to teachers who will say, you can see in a particular age group coming through that they may not be, you know, as advanced at maths, or they might not be as advanced at various subjects. But it would be unusual if that wasn't the case, right?
I know.
I mean, if you close the schools, is it going to affect the kids' development and the kids' education? It is. But remember, there were no easy decisions. This was about the kind of decisions you're making are, well, if we keep them open, how many people are likely to die if we do that? So that's what you were having to balance in terms of any public health restrictions, you know?
They were heady times, weren't they? You got a lot of hate from a lot of quarters, did you?
I think when I came in in July 2020. And any novelty value that some might have had about being able to stay home for a while and all of that was gone. And you remember, we all thought this would probably be an 8 week, a 12 week thing. And it was becoming very clear that actually we were going to have to live with this for years. There were no vaccines. Back in July, there wasn't even any talk of vaccines. In fact, I talked to one virologist who said it'll be years before we have a vaccine for this. And I think the reality was really beginning to set in. And I think people were getting very frustrated. There were more and more situations where the public health measures were really hurting people, like not being able to visit loved ones in a nursing home, or restrictions on the size of a funeral.
And did you become, if you will, the vector for that for a lot of people?
Well,
I think, of all that?
Yeah, well, look, I was the Minister for Health. So inevitably you're going to become the focus for a certain amount of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, take it outside of media and politics. Were there personal attacks on you, on your family, on your home?
Yeah, the home was targeted. repeatedly. Yeah, we had to move the kids' beds away from the windows in their rooms because their windows were getting targeted and
things thrown at their windows.
Yeah, and
rocks,
various things, and people banging on the windows, and you know, banging on the front door in the middle of the night, and
people outside your house banging on the doors and windows.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a bit of that.
Is your house off the road?
No, it's very close to the road.
Right.
So the OPW put up a fence to create a bit of a barrier.
Come here. What when that's going on? How are your kids coping? Your wife?
Well, you just get on with it, don't you?
Get on with it, but for them.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, and you know, while this was going on, you know, we were still. You know, we were working every hour of the day, 7 days a week, to try and find vaccines, get ready for vaccines, you know, public health measures, try and keep people safe. So, it was tough. It was not an easy time for my wife. The kids were young, which helps, you know, but even the kid who was, he would have been 5 or 6 at some of the protests outside the house. Yeah, he was only talking to me about them the other day. You know, there was quite a number of people outside.
What did he say?
I won't get into what he was just kind of recounting some of it. You know, there was one where they had a motorbike outside that was revving very loudly, and there were signs kind of up over the fence that they could see through the bedroom windows. And so he had a sense that there was, you know, a lot of angry people outside.
Did it take a toll on you personally? Does it change you?
It probably does, but I probably can't answer that question yet. You know, we had to remain absolutely focused on what we were doing work-wise, you know, and I'm a middle-aged Irish man, so I'm probably emotionally stunted to begin with.
Okay.
It'll probably take time.
It'll come out in an inappropriate way at some stage when you're
I'm sure you know.
Has the whole 14 years changed you?
Oh, unquestionably, you know. Yeah. But would any of us look back and say I'm the same person I was 14 years ago?
No, you know? But how do you think the experience in politics in particular changed you? Because there's times where it felt that you got a fair old battering in the media and everything. Does it make you less confident, less cocky? Does it make you more careful?
It does make you more careful. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about kind of the negative sides of it.
Yeah, we'll talk about the positives.
There are hugely positive sides.
We'll talk about the positive
as
in a minute.
Well, I think what it does, Brendan, is we're in a world of social media now. And we're in a world where anything that happens, people will pick up their phone and video it, right? So for any public figure, this isn't about me, for any public figure, particularly for politicians, because it seems to be just open season, you know, you can say what you want, you can write what you want, you can post what you want. You censor yourself. You have to become much more careful in public, you know, even things you might say in a pub. You know, there's no dancing on the tables. You know, you have to be, you know, and you become a little, you do. It definitely changes it. You know,
would your friends and your wife say you've changed? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting what my friends are saying to me, my close friends, almost to a man and a woman after the election. They said, we're gutted for you personally, because we know how much this means to you and how much, you know, you care about doing what you do. But they said, to be honest, we're glad you're out and we're looking forward to having you back, because we haven't really seen you in 10 years and you're way less cracked than you used to be. So I think it does. But it also changes you in very positive ways.
Yeah. And look, and you've talked about your successes as health minister, a new consultant contract, we're bringing in this productivity stuff, progressing Sláinte Care. We're told that, hallelujah, the digitalization of the health service will start going online this summer. Mm. I think we learn more from our failures, though. Right, they're well aired.
Yeah,
the successes.
We
learn more from our failures.
We do.
What were your failures?
Over 14 years
as Minister for Health.
As Minister for Health. Well, my biggest regret is a lack of time. right? It was a 4.5-year term. The first 2 years was taken up entirely by COVID. There was a huge job to be done to get the health service moving the right way. Remember, go back to 2020. Our health service was not in a good place. People were waiting longer and longer to get to see a doctor, longer and longer to see a GP, longer and longer to get an X-ray or an MRI. Productivity was decreasing. So even though there was a lot more money and there were more healthcare workers, the amount of kind of say outpatient care being delivered wasn't going up. So
what, were they not working hard?
Oh, they were working hard, but they didn't have the tools they needed, and there wasn't a culture of productivity. So as you say, there was no e-health. You know, we had people driving around the country with paper files. We had doctors in Kerry University Hospital trying to, you know, do their work in their car in the car park because they couldn't get a clinical room, or they couldn't get rooms. We're blessed with our healthcare workers. Our healthcare workers are phenomenal in this country, but they didn't have the tools that they needed. And the result of that, why that matters, is because it was getting harder and harder for patients to access care. And so we needed to turn all of that around. And so my biggest regret is we only really had 2.5 years. And so a lot of the things that we've started, like bringing in like digital health, like a culture of productivity, which requires, it's an awful lot of, you know, dull managerial work in the background, but it's essential and it has to be done. The consultant contract is in, as you say. There's a lot of reforms we've brought in and there's a lot of extra capacity we've brought in, but it takes time. It takes time for patients to feel it. So for example...
So you didn't have the time to get to grips with the system is kind of what you're saying.
We did get to grips with the system, but the kind of changes that we were making, we did three things. We increased the capacity a lot. We took a strategic view, which hadn't really been taken before. And we did an awful lot of reform. So those things are happening.
Okay, but we live in a very rich country. Yeah, people are dying in our A&Es because they're like war zones. Kids who are, you know, in grave danger to themselves, waiting years sometimes for CAMHS, say, for example. You know, I could go on with the list. Mm. So why is that? Are we not spending enough money, or is the system dysfunctional?
The answer is... the system wasn't, when this government came in 2020, the health service was not working for patients for lots of different reasons. Some of them we've covered. They didn't have enough beds. They didn't have enough doctors, nurses and therapists. They didn't have digital health. They didn't have sufficient primary care centres. There's lots of reasons, right? There wasn't this culture of productivity, which you have to have. That's what we've been working on, and that's all moving. So let me take a few examples. Probably the single biggest patient safety question is how long does it take for you to get to see a hospital consultant after your GP has referred you in? And that doubled between about 2016 and at the height of COVID, doubled. It's now halved. So in the last 3 years, that's halved. It's gone down from whatever it was, nearly 8 months to or 13 months to, I haven't got the exact figure, but it's halved. The number of people waiting more than a year has gone down a lot. The number of patients on trolleys last year was 13,000 less, right? And this is why I talk about regret, because there's still far too many patients on trolleys. Some hospitals have none, and a growing number have none and have stabilised. But there are far too many cases where the EDs are overcrowded, and there's still far too many people waiting far too long to get access to healthcare. And it's moving. It's now moving in the right direction. But you'd love a full 5-year term to really make sure that people in the country felt as much of a difference as possible.
What's the one piece of advice you'd give to Jennifer Carl-McNeill as she goes into this job? Not policy advice, just... generally on how to approach it.
I think the advice I'd give any new minister is you can be fearless in representing the public, right? We're very fortunate in Ireland with we've great we have a very good civil service, and we generally have very good state agencies, you know, and I work very closely with Bernard Gloucester, who heads the HSE, and Robert Watt, who heads the Department of Health. But civil servants, and this isn't just healthcare, civil servants and public servants are bound by the rules, as they must be, right? The minister is probably the one person in the room who can say, I don't really care what the rule is, and I don't care what the protocols are, and I'm not terribly concerned about the legal advice. In fact, you can go so far as to say, I'm not even concerned that that's the law, because we can change the law. What we're going to do is we're going to do the right thing for this child, or we're going to do the right thing for this family. And if that requires breaking the rules, if it requires changing the law, if it requires getting new money and doing things in a way they've never been done before, then that's what we're going to do.
Just do it. Yeah. Okay. Are you done?
Am I done?
Yeah. Are you finished with politics?
For now, yes.
What does that mean?
Who knows what the future holds? Well, it means I'm not a TD and I didn't run for the Shannon. So for now, like, clearly I'm out of politics.
Okay, you're out of it. Would you like to go back into it soon?
It's far too early to say it. It's certainly not where my head is right now. Like, my passions are public service and healthcare. And there's lots of different ways you can do that, you know, be it working with the WHO, be it working with private companies who are coming up with amazing new medicines or amazing new AI interventions, or directly helping healthcare providers. There's lots of different ways to help. So as I say, I only finished up 9 days ago. So I'm gonna think through all of that.
If the Taoiseach offered you a seat in the Shannon in the coming days, would you take it?
Well, he won't offer me a seat in the Shannon in the coming days.
How do you know? Did you ask?
No, I didn't. But
has it been said to you that he won't?
No. But it's not a conversation we've had. It's just not a conversation I would expect. So really, that's what I want to focus on. You know, when we think about healthcare, Brendan, there are changes coming now that are probably the biggest changes since antibiotics started, which were, you know, in the 60s, really, is when I think they became mainstream in the hospitals. Between personalized medicine, genetics, AI, all sorts of new technologies and things that are coming our way, we have the potential for healthcare to be almost unrecognizable in 15 years compared to what it is today. And it's a really exciting place to be. And critically for me, in terms of public service, it means you're doing something that helps.
Okay.
That helps.
But people. That might be in the private sector.
Yeah.
I presume anyone who goes into politics has a healthy ego, do they?
I don't know. Look, it's a funny one, isn't it? Like, yeah, they probably do. Like, if you're going to put yourself forward, if you're mad enough to get your photograph taken and get it printed up on big bits of cardboard and stick it up a load of lampposts, you have to believe that you can make things better for people. Otherwise, what are you doing? Like, that's the only reason to be in politics that I've ever seen is to help people. It's just to make things better for people. So I think if you're going to do that and you're going to ask, you're going to run fundraisers, I'm going to say, Brendan, can you donate €100 to my campaign so I can print more leaflets about all the good things my party and I want to do? You have to have a sense of self-belief, yeah.
And is that bruised for now?
With me?
Is your ego bruised for now?
Ah, no. Like, if you run for, because I didn't get elected.
Yeah, yeah.
No, look, if you run for election, you have to accept you may or may not get elected. And I knew this was going to be a tough one, you know. There were two of the three I got elected in where certainly the bookies wouldn't have given me much chance. This one, they gave me a better chance. I didn't get in. No, I don't think you can think like that.
Okay.
You know, I think you just have to look and say, it goes back to this, right? What happened in the constituency happened. I made a conscious decision to work night and day for the health service.
Okay.
And did that ultimately come at a cost? It probably did. But do I regret making that decision? No, it was the right decision to make, I think.
Okay. Okay, Stephen Donnelly, thank you very much. That was really interesting, and best of luck
Thanks,
with whatever's next.